Hello and welcome to the Keeper Cup podcast. I'm Chad Young. Pete Ball is here with me. We are on to episode 135 here on the Pitcherlist podcast network. And it's now May, Pete. So I feel like all through April, every time something's not going well with my team or something is going well with my team, or I ask somebody a question, they're like, it's still April. Now it's May, so everything's real. So it's time to panic, right?
Oh, yeah, 100%. It's time to just start dropping Ronald Acuna, you know, cut Kevin Gausman, even though he was brilliant yesterday. Time to do some drastic things.
Yep, I'm getting aggressive. Now, I actually I'm not cutting my Acunas. I'm not selling low on Gausman. But what I am doing is getting more aggressive on guys at the bottom of the roster.
Sure.
Right. Those guys that you were like, oh, I think this guy could break out this year. I'm gonna take a shot at him. You give them a couple weeks. You give them maybe the month of April to see what they can do. And then at some point you gotta be like, you know what? It ain't happening.
Hey, one of those guys.
This is definitely that point.
One of those guys I just did right before we started recording. It's a very shallow league. It's my work league, so very fun. It's free, all that stuff. It's just 10 teams, but I cut Wyatt Langford, man. I'm sorry. There's just better, more productive players on free agency, and the hamstring or potential hamstring injury kind of, you know, put the nail in that coffin. So see you later.
Yeah, I cut Buxton in the Podcasters League. Right. He's hurt again. He's been terrible. I think, you know, I picked him up in that league because he was only $7. Mm-hmm. Just nobody wanted to bid him up in that 5x5. And I was like, at $7, sure.
Yeah.
I'll take a shot. And this is something you and I have talked about with Buxton a lot. Is like the challenge with Buxton in the past has been the price was too high. The price came down. That price was good enough. But I'd been saying all offseason, like everyone was like, oh, his knee is healthy. If he can stay on the field. And I was like, all right, I hear you, and he does seem healthier, and maybe he can stay on the field. Probably not, but maybe he can. But he's also been really bad for a little bit now. And that was the thing for me, that it was like, he's been bad again. And so now we're going on over a year of him not being a productive player, even when he is healthy. And so now that he's here, I forget it.
Yep.
But Langford, we should maybe, usually we start with jersey numbers. We take our time getting into stuff, but I want to talk Langford a little bit because I think it's an interesting drop. And I think it does bring up an interesting dynamic that we're going to talk about again later from one of the questions we got, which is the difference between redraft and keeper leagues, right? And we are keeper cut. We are a keeper league focused podcast. I assume where you dropped Langford, that was a redraft.
Oh yeah. 100%. 10 team redraft. And he should be dropped in those formats at this point.
I think that's right. And I even think if you're in a keeper league, that's one of those like keep three and there's no cost associated with it, it might be okay to just say, forget it. But I think that it's a really interesting situation because let's say, you know, Langford right now, if you drafted him in redraft, you've lost a month, right? The last month has been terrible. He has underperformed what you could have gotten at that point, and you've hurt your team by having him. And for at least a week or two there, you were probably starting him every day, which makes it even worse. If he's been glued to your bench for the last couple of weeks, at least he isn't actively hurting you. Now he's hurt. He might be out for a little bit, but even if he's back pretty soon and you know, works his way back in shape, it might take him, like if this slump, let's call it a slump, let's assume it's a slump. If this goes on for another month, you're not talking a third of your value for him, just gone, right? In a keeper league or in a dynasty league, let's say that same thing plays out. It takes him another month. He really does nothing. June comes along and he starts to hit his stride. You've lost 2 months. That 2 months of season, if you think you might keep him for, let's say, 4 years, I don't often like to look at a longer time horizon than your 3 to 5 years, three-ish, whatever. So say 4 years. That's 24 months of baseball. Losing two of those because he wasn't very good, you can live with that. And you can hold him through this slump and be very, very happy long-term that you did that. And so it's really, at this point, a very, very different conversation for a guy like him, for really anybody. Because if you give up on them in a keeper league versus redraft, the cost of giving up on them is so much higher, right? And so like, you know, I could make a case that right now you drop Langford for Joe Adell and ride the hot streak, even though I don't know that Adell is going to keep it up. For Willier Abreu, who's been really good for your Red Sox, right? Like in a redraft, sometimes you just need to make those moves and get guys who are producing for you. in a keeper or dynasty type format, you can't do it. And so it's a really interesting sort of dichotomy in the debate, and something we probably need to be really, we need to talk about that, Pete, obviously, because it's our that's what our show is about. So it's important to remember.
Yep. Nope. Absolutely is. And it that's why I never, even in my keeper leagues, I don't want to have too many prospects, because chances are at least multiple of them, if you have them, are not going to be exactly what you were hoping for. There's two guys today I know we're going to talk about that kind of both relate to this conversation, even though one of them's not a prospect anymore. And if you surround yourself with too many of these guys, you really run the risk of your team kind of bottoming out. And I think we're seeing that with players who we expect to have great futures. Just right now, they're not playing well.
Yeah. So we will talk more about that, but let's jump into our jersey number discussion. We're talking about jersey 35 for episode 135. And this one, Pete, I mean, especially if you include the guys who didn't wear this jersey for all or even most of their career, but wore it at least a little bit, 35, there are some like star inner circle type guy, you know, Ricky Henderson wore it for 8 years, Joe Morgan for one, Phil Niekro is at the top of the list for guys who really are, you know, he wore it for 24 years, accruing 96 WAR in that time. Gaylord Perry wore it for a couple of years, Mike Mussina wore it for 17 years, Justin Verlander, Frank Thomas, like, There are some studs who wore this number. It's a fun one.
Yeah, this is a tough one. I see Verlander, and you know, that's more my kind of like age range here, and those are my fantasy years. So I'm partial to him, but this is a great list of players who wore 35.
Yeah, I mean, I think Thomas is really the name that stands out for me. Verlander and Mussina, both star players during my lifetime. Henderson belongs on that list too, but he only wore it for 8 years, and so I'm gonna ignore that. But those two pitchers are guys who, like, yeah, my fantasy playing years, stuff like that, just absolute stars. Mussina, I just, all those years with the Yankees and facing Cleveland in the playoffs, Verlander in Cleveland's division and then with Houston, Thomas also in Cleveland's division for a long time, but at a not in a as damaging a way to my teams, and so I don't have as many hard feelings towards Frank Thomas, and he was just an awesome hitter. I think in some ways underrated these days. I think, like, people think back to those, you know, 90s, 2000s, and there's all the talk about the home run chase and about Bonds and even McGuire and Sosa. And I think at some level, Frank Thomas gets ignored in that, you know, throw Griffey into that group, throw A-Rod into that group. And you can understand why, like, those guys are all, you know, stars at maybe another level in terms of like their fame and stuff like that. But Frank Thomas was as scary a hitter as you could face in the league for a long, long time.
Yeah, no, I'm definitely good with this being the Frank Thomas episode. Locally, he's one of the more notable Cape Cod League veterans. He played in the Cape League for a year or two. So, I'm good with Frank Thomas for sure.
It's also fitting because I feel like a lot of the conversations we're going to have today are about people being frustrated or upset. And so the Big Hurt might be an appropriate name.
Yeah, the Big Hurt. That's the name of the episode now.
Yeah, there you go. So this episode, we sent out a request for questions and or hot takes from our listeners, and we're gonna discuss some of those. And so we're going to start off with this one, which came from Kevin Conlin at KevinConlin12 on Twitter. He wants to know, is Mason Miller a sell high? He's been super valuable, and the SP eligibility helps in many leagues. Not so worried about him getting save opportunities, but is he nearing his peak value given injury history and current hype? Pete, you want to take a first stab at this?
Yeah, for sure. So my season's been up and down. In some leagues, I'm doing extremely well. In others, I'm really not. TGFBI comes to mind. And my most rostered player is Mason Miller. That's not, you know, like it comes across as a brag, but I'm heavily invested in this player. So I might be a little biased here, but you know, something they've been talking about quite a bit on FBT over on CBS is just pitching and injuries have been so unpredictable and so common that when you have an elite pitcher, just take the production. Just take elite pitching while you can get it. The whole point of Oakland moving Mason Miller to the bullpen was to keep him healthy. And so far that's working, and it's working really, really well, knock on wood. So I don't have any interest in moving that, especially with how difficult pitching's been. Yeah. I understand selling high in general. And like, if you can get a King's ransom for him, then sure, do it, because he's a closer and I only value those guys so much, even in rotisserie leagues. Obviously, if he's the only one, I wouldn't want to move him. I also think Oakland sucks, which they do. They've been a little bit better than expected, but I don't think he's going to post some crazy save total either, even though they've kind of been rolling in lately. So from that perspective, sure, I'd always sell high on a closer, but I'm not actively looking to move him while he's pitching this well. I think that would be silly. Take elite production while you can get it. We just saw this week, Grayson Rodriguez looked fine in his outing. The velocity was fine. The spin rates were fine. Down he goes with a shoulder injury. Like, trying to predict it just because Mason Miller has had a history, I have no interest in doing that. He's pitching well. I'm going to hold on to him because I need pitching.
Yeah, I'm going to take a slightly different give a slightly different answer. But before I answer that, I do want to point out he is striking out 53.7% of hitters. He is walking only 7.4% of hitters.
Keep that on your
theory. you could see a lower walk rate. But that is just insane.
Keep that on your roster
numbers. I think that's right, and I think if you're competing, it'd be. I don't know that you can sell high enough to really make it make sense. In keeper, in dynasty, I do think that injury history is worth paying attention to. And I think if you're in a situation, especially if on a team that isn't having a great year, or where you have significant needs that aren't pitching, I think the other half of this question, because the question started with, is he a sell high? But the other half of this was, is he nearing peak value given his injury history and current hype? Yes, he's at his peak value. He will never be more valuable than he is now. Because even if he continues to pitch like this, there's no up for him from here, right? This is the ceiling, other than maybe him having done this for another couple months and people being like, oh, maybe he really will stay healthy. Like, maybe there's still enough residual concern that just being healthy for another month will help. But I think given his history, we're at least a year away from people changing their perception of him as an injury risk, right? If he still looks good in July, I think you're still going to have a lot of people, and I'll probably be one of them, to be honest, thinking he looks good now, but like the history's bad, and you have to be aware of that. So like, yes, I do think he is nearing his peak value. And I think if you look at your team and you're thinking, this guy is not helping me win right now because my team's not ready for that, or I'm stacked in the bullpen and I don't need another relief arm, it's auto new where the SP eligibility doesn't matter. Like, in the right circumstances, yes, I think you could sell high because of the second half of this question, because he is at his, I think, peak value. I don't think he'll ever be more valuable than he is now. But if you're looking for pitching and your team needs every inning it can get, which I think is almost every team right now, it feels like, I'm sort of with you that if you're contending, like, just take the stats while you get them. Because I just don't think you're going to replace him with anything that can do what he is doing. Because what he's doing is crazy.
What he's doing is absolutely crazy. And I want to reiterate from that angle, I actually agree, especially if you're a rebuilding team. Because if you're a rebuilding team, I don't care who the closer is, that's the first place I'm looking to trade. So from that perspective, 100%. I just, when it comes to injury history with pitchers, I think my mindset is just shifting a little bit. Because, like, I mean, all right, then let's trade Spencer Strider. Like, Tarek Skubal's had Tommy John and he's routinely throwing like 99 miles an hour now. So like, let's trade him too. Like, there's no safe pitcher out there that we can just be like, this guy's going to stay healthy. He has no injury history. I know Mason Miller's injury history is really unique, but he's also only pitching like four innings a week at most. And I think that matters here. So he's just a player I have a hard time moving right now because of the current state of pitching. And the idea of bringing injury history into today's game is like, I think we can just apply that to literally any pitcher. And any pitcher that hasn't had Tommy John yet, is there even more concern because they're probably just going to have it? Like, that's basically where I'm at with the injury game.
So let me actually, I'm going to go to a question that I got in the AutoNew Slack. That's related to this. So the question here came from Ballpark Beers, good name, in the AutoNew Slack. He says, how should /can fantasy managers, especially in AutoNew, strategically adjust to the current heightened velocity /injury correlation for starting pitchers? And then he adds some context. He says, all the guys we're supposed to chase get hurt, and all the metrics which have equated to value and effectiveness pretty clearly have a shelf life which intersects with value in some unexpected ways this season. I think he's saying is like, you know, you want guys who throw hard and have good spin rates and stuff, but then those are the same guys who seem to get hurt. Real life baseball front offices and development teams are inevitably incentivized under current conditions to chase velo, but is there a creative way to think about this from a fantasy perspective? He says he's speaking of the big hurt episode. He finishes, speaking as a traumatized manager who lost Strider, Yuri, Taj, Bobby Miller, Luzardo across my teams this year. And the thing about that list is, you read that list, you're like, oh man, that's brutal. I think that's just normal.
Yeah, that's actually, you know, that's like actually a pretty tamed list, especially since two of those guys should be back soon.
Yeah. But I think it's an interesting question, and it relates to what we're talking about with Miller is like, and it sounds like what you're saying is like, look, just take the numbers while you get them. And if the guy gets hurt, he gets hurt, but use the performance while you can.
I mean, that's really what it is. And it kind of reminds me of, like, for a different reason, but how fantasy used to be back when I started playing in like 2007, 2008, which is like, if I have an elite pitcher, I'm going to take the production, but if you're going to offer me an elite hitter, I'm just going to value that more because that production's more safe. That production has always been more safe with hitters versus pitchers, but now you add in that increased injury risk. And like, basically, if you're going to offer me a first or second round hitter for a top 10 starting pitcher, I might just take the hitter in my long-term leagues because I'll be able to bank on that production going forward. In a redraft league, I might value the pitcher more because they're just producing so well right now, and it's so hard to find that I just want to hold on to it. And so I think that's how you kind of adjust. Like, if you're in it to win it now and you have a pitcher who's pitching well, don't overthink things and get rid of the guy. Could he get injured tomorrow and miss the next calendar year? Yeah, he could. But so could any of your other pitchers or any of your opponent's pitchers. It's just the way of the game right now. So if you have one that's pitching well, like Mason Miller in this case, hold on tight.
Yeah, I think the sort of general question here of like, is there a way that we can think differently? I will say, like, if you go back and look at, you know, a list of the highest velocities year over year, there's like a very clear correlation between throwing hard and getting hurt. And I don't know that, you know, correlation does not imply causation. Like, we shouldn't assume that just because someone throws hard, they're going to get hurt, but it certainly feels that way right now. And so I do think that there is like, I am more hesitant, and this is more about starters than relievers. I think relievers are a little bit, it's a different thing because the stress in the arm is different. The number of throws is different. But starters who are over like 96 to 97 miles per hour, something in that range, I do start to get a little bit nervous. I'm with you. Like, if I've got like Dylan Cease is at 97.1 this year, he's been excellent. There might be reasons to sell high in Dylan Cease, which is but it's not related to me. Like, I'm not like bailing on Dylan Cease because of the velocity. However, if I'm buying starting pitching, which I'm going to have to do in some of my leagues, or if I'm starting to think about drafts in the future, I think, and like, I'm looking at right now a Fangraphs leaderboard by WAR of starting pitchers. Now, WAR is not the best way for fantasy to look at this, but it's just going to bring me a name of effective pitchers so far. And there are some guys on here that are near the top. Cutter Crawford, 93.4 on his fastball. Zach Wheeler, 95, which is a little bit higher, but like, Wheeler's got a nice long history of being healthy at this point. George Kirby at 95.8 is pushing up, but really hasn't shown any signs of injury risk. Ranger Suarez, 92.5. Zach Little, Shota Imanaga. Like, there's a handful of guys here who are either have a history of being healthy. Luis Castillo falls under that history of being healthy, I think. Logan Webb doesn't throw as hard and has a history of being healthy. Like, there's guys who either don't throw as hard or have a history of being healthy or both. And I do think I'm going to pivot my thinking to be less velo focused and more just like, where can I get reliably good performance? And it has to be good, right? I'm not looking for like, oh, Kyle Hendricks is often healthy and like can throw lots of innings. Wade Miley is a great innings eater. The Wade Miley's hurts. It's a terrible example. But it used to be a good example. But like, I do think I'm going to, in like future rankings, like I think I'm going to push up a guy like Wheeler over someone who has an injury history or who throws harder and I'm more worried about, because I think it matters. And I think at this point, if you had gone out and said, I'm not taking any starting pitcher who throws 96 plus, I'm going to take at any time I want to take a pitcher in a draft or an auction, I'm going to pay for the best pitcher who isn't that hard a thrower, I think you'd probably be better off right now than if you grabbed all the hardest throwers.
So, I guess if you hit on the right ones, it is funny that sure. Like we're mentioning Zach Wheeler now as like the bastion of health, considering the grand scope of his career. But I mean, hey, he's a consistent producer at this point. I just think, I think that's tough. Like, the reason why guys are throwing harder and spinning the ball harder is because that's what they need to do to get modern major league hitters out. And so sure. Like, it's just the natural evolution of the game. And I don't know how you strategically and successfully plan against that. And I think that's just what makes this so difficult. I was listening to Rates and Barrels this week from The Athletic. That's Eno Saris and Derek Van Riper. And I'm trying to find what Eno was referencing, but there was some research done. I want to say it was on Fangraphs, but I can't remember who it was. That was like trying to locate the number one reasons why so many pitchers are getting hurt. And believe it or not, velocity wasn't the number one reason. I have an idea in my head what the number one reason was, and I'm going to try and find it before the podcast is over. I would just suggest listening to that episode. I believe it was their second most recent episode about why Acuña is struggling so much. But I thought it had to do with breaking ball usage or so. I don't want to say something's wrong, but there's research out there that would suggest it's not just a velo thing, which just throws another wrench into this disaster of trying to predict pitcher injuries.
I don't think it's just a velo thing. I think it's an absolute given that there is no one obvious answer, because if there were, there would be a major league team that had figured that out, and it would probably be someone really smart like the Dodgers or the Astros.
It could be the Red Sox. Could be the Red Sox. We're throwing the least amount of fastballs, and we got the best starting pitching in baseball so far.
And among those guys I mentioned who aren't throwing as hard was Cutter Crawford. And Hauk fits into this too, right? Hauk's not a super hard thrower.
He's not, no.
So, I mean, maybe there is something to it. Maybe that is like actually something the Red Sox have targeted. I don't know. We'll see. But I do think
easy,
like,
easy schedule in terms of opposing hitting.
Sure. Yeah. But regardless, I think if I'm... To get back to the question that Ballpark Beers had asked, is there something you can do strategically? I think for me, I'm going to put a bigger premium on a true history of health. And like I said, Wheeler falls into that. Like, I know Wheeler had his injury issues early in his career, but we're going on like almost a decade now of Wheeler being just a reliable workhorse. That matters to me. And I think I'm not going to chase velocity. That doesn't mean I'm going to be like, oh, I'm passing on this guy who throws 97 for a guy who's like way, way, way worse. But if I'm at a point in a draft, an auction, trade talks, and there are two guys I'm looking at and one of them is a really hard thrower and then one of them isn't, I think I'm going to prioritize the not as hard thrower. It has to be a good pitcher, right? To your point, it's not just like, give me your soft tossers. That's not what I'm saying here. But like, if I got two pitchers and I like them both and one throws 93 and one throws 97, I think I'll take the guy who throws 93. I just think they're that may not be the number one thing that drives injury risk, but I think there's enough of a correlation there to suggest it's worth being cautious. So,
and the only trouble is going to be those guys, like, are just so rare. Like, I mean, I guess, like, Zach Wheeler,
yeah,
if he has another season like he's had the last few years and he stays healthy, like, he's probably going to be the first or second pitcher off the board. I mean, who else do we put in that class that doesn't throw absolute gas but has ace level production or even good enough production? Because some of these guys, like, okay, they could have had a good April, maybe they had a pretty solid 2023, but if your skills don't line up with the numbers that you're producing, I'm still going to be a little bit hesitant to draft you because I just assume that bottom is going to fall out at some point. So that it's just a separate dance, right? It's not the avoid injury dance, but it's a, can you keep up this production or am I gonna have to pay out the nose to get you dance?
Yeah, I think that's right. So let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll look at some guys who are underperforming and discuss what we think you should do with them. All right, welcome back. We are talking on the Keeper Cup podcast, answering listener questions and hot takes. And I've got a guy who's come up in a couple of places of questions that the question from Twitter is, can Jose Ramirez get back to being a high OBP 2020 guy? That's from at Jeff Long 9521.
I think he's just trying to piss you off with this question.
He might be. But I also, so in my food and travel league, Jose Ramirez got traded for Jackson Holliday. And I sort of snarkily, tongue in cheek, posted, if you trade two guys who are underperforming but probably aren't sell lows, does that still count as a sell low? Or, like, is it selling high? Or, like, how does that work when they're both in that, you know? And so I got some people were, when I asked for questions, were like, oh, is Jose just busted? Is he just done? But Jose Ramirez, I have him on multiple teams, in addition to the fact that the Guardians are somehow succeeding. Ish is not a fair thing. They are definitely succeeding. I have real concerns about the sustainability of the Guardians. That's a whole different story. But they are in first place. They're a game and a half up in the Central, despite the fact that Jose has clearly not been what you would expect him to be. His WOBA for his career is 357. If you go back the last, 3 years, 372, 363, 346 last year, is heading down, 287 this year. That's not what we expect from him. I do think it is worth noting on Jose that he's still on pace to be a 2020 guy. They've played about a fifth of their games and he has 5 home runs and 4 stolen bases, which would be a 25-20 season. The on base percentage is actually, like, I have some concerns right now, but I think he's just pressing right now. And he seems to go through these phases where he presses, but his strikeout rate is still totally fine, 11.9% for his career, 11.2% this year. His walk rate is way down. It's 5.6%. That would be a career low. His BAPIP is way down. It's 221. That would also be a career low. It is worth noting that he's a generally low-ish BAPIP guy. He's 280. Like, fly ball hitter. He pulls the ball a ton. He doesn't, like, spray it all fields. Like, he's not a high BAPIP guy, even though he hits a decent number of line drives and is a good, he's a good base runner. I think people think he's fast. He's not that fast. He's more a good base runner. However, and this is where I get a little concerned, his chase rate right now is 38.1%. That would be a career high, and a career high by a lot. He has never been over 30.9% he was 32.3%, 2 years ago. But, like, that's a huge jump there. His Z swing is also well above his career numbers, so he is just generally swinging more than he ever has. This is the first year of his career that his swing rate is over 50%. Ramirez had a career high swing rate coming into the season of 47.6%. That was way back in his second season when he was, like, if it seems so long ago, but if you guys remember the early days of Jose Ramirez, he was not Jose Ramirez yet. And so, in his, this is a pretty big, a good, like, 5% higher than he's been at any other point in his effective career, the best part of his career, the good part of his career. I just think he needs to just calm down. Like, I know it seems easy to say, but I actually think it's just a matter of him, like, just settling back in and being like, you know what? There's enough hitters in this lineup around me that I don't need to do everything. we're winning even though I'm playing like crap. And so if I just settle back to being myself, things will be fine. At least that's what I'm hoping. So that's my read on Jose. Do you have any other thoughts other than Jeff just trying to give me a hard time?
I'm not so sure it was to give you a hard time. I'm sure there are plenty of people who have Jose Ramirez who are frustrated. I mean, if you remember, Chad, in Listener League One, it was like, oh, I have three first round players, and it was Matt Olson, Jose Ramirez, and Corbin Carroll. And needless to say, it has not worked out that great.
No.
With that said, a couple things. I don't know if it's a club approach, but Cleveland is fourth in baseball in Z swing. So, you know, maybe he's just being encouraged to swing more. And quite frankly, I'm okay with Jose Ramirez swinging more because I think the results are eventually going to follow. Folks might remember, if they've been playing long enough, Jose Ramirez at 2 points in his career had two of like the worst slumps that were just so bad. One of them was almost a season long and ultimately resulted in him going in like the second or third round the following season. He's just an elite player. I don't think there's some skill deterioration here. If you can buy low on Jose Ramirez, then go buy low on Jose Ramirez. I fully expect him to go 2020. Like you said, he's on pace for that. And, you know, I think the walk rate being under 6% right now is weird. I'll absolutely grant you that. But again, I just think everything's going to level out. I mean, he's been such an established stud, a top, literal top one performer in fantasy seasons in the past, that I'm going to need to see a lot more for me to be overly concerned about Jose Ramirez.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I think my concern amps up as a, not as a fantasy manager, right? If Jose Ramirez were the starting third baseman for like, I don't know, some random team, who's the most random team I can think of that it wouldn't hurt me to think about him being on that team? The Nationals. It wouldn't hurt me if you were in the Nationals. If you were the starting third baseman for the Nationals, I'd be like, yeah, there's nothing to worry about here. My natural Cleveland sports anxiety gets the better of me, and I start to worry more about the guys in Cleveland. But I think he'll be fine. Let's look at another, you know, first round talent who is struggling so far. This is a question I got on a recent article. I wrote an article on Fangraphs this week that looked at changes in projections on the Bat X. So from preseason to now, whose projections for WOBA have moved the most? One of the biggest fallers was Acuna. Ronald Acuna Jr., the clear 1.1 in every draft this year. Now, his projection has fallen from a 416 WOBA to a 411 WOBA. That's not like some crazy, you know. It is the eighth largest drop. I'm still trying to figure out one of the interesting things in this article. If you go check it out, I talk about it a little bit there, but the drop, like, there are way more gains than drops. Most players have improved their projection. I think that might have to do with like weather, offensive environment, things like that. That the Bat X is just expecting the rest of the season to have more offense than April did, which is totally expectable and makes sense. But regardless, Acuna's drop, eighth largest drop among players who had both a preseason and an in-season projection. It still leaves him as a star level player. Fine. Comment on that article from Corey 2 says, I was looking at Acuna's stat line because the Braves came to Seattle last week. There's some weird looking things happening that seem worthy of exploration. Not really sure what they mean. Strikeouts. Last year he had an 11.4% strikeout rate. That's amazing for the kind of power he hit for last year. And it was down a shocking 12% from 2022. Strikeout rates don't tend to be particularly volatile, but this year so far, he's up to 27.7%, almost a career high. Isolated slugging. He's always had a high isolated slugging percentage, but this year it's really low, 0.092, particularly in context of a massive rise in strikeouts. That seemed concerning. I guess a year like Acuna's last season might always be an outlier just because of how good it was, but I'm wondering if it might turn out to be more of an outlier than we would think. Maybe Acuna really isn't the superstar we've been regarding him as. So that is a hot take. It is a hot take that I'm not going to take. I think Acuna is not a superstar because of what he did last year. Acuna is a superstar because of his career trajectory to date. But I do think it leads to an interesting question of how do you think about Acuna moving forward? And, you know, are there regrets about taking him 1.1? Is he, you know, Do you feel differently today than you did before?
I mean, in redraft, if we were to start a redraft league today, who are you taking above Ronald Acuña? Just Mookie Betts? I mean, Juan Soto has four steals, so like that's interesting. Bobby Witt's been in the conversation. He's off to a good start, I guess, but even he only has four homers, which isn't, blasting the doors off. So
we're going to answer a question. We're going to answer a question later from Scott Chu from Pitcher List, who writes the hitter list at Pitcher List. And so he just, he publishes his weekly top 150. He still has Acuña's number one in his weekly top 150. He's got Witt 2, Betts 3, Ohtani 4, Tucker 5. If you want to know who's sort of in the conversation, at least in his mind, but he's still the 1.1 if you had to make a draft today.
Yeah, I think so too. I think the person who asked the question raises a really good point about the strikeout rate, because it just looks like right now the 2023 strikeout rate is a serious, serious outlier. And so where is that going to hit Acuña the most? Well, it's going to hit Acuña the most in batting average. And right now, it looks like 2023 is a serious, serious outlier in batting average. So if you account for that, like a return to somewhat normalcy for the strikeout rate, maybe the gains that we thought he made, he didn't actually make. And he's not going to hurt you in batting average, but he's not this amazing asset. And then you also account for the fact that last year was one of the single best fantasy seasons in baseball history, and that there was some natural regression to take place, which, again, the person who asked the question acknowledged that could be the case. Then you still have a guy who like could easily go 30-40, still be the number one player, and just not be who he was last year. So I still view him as an absolute elite superstar who probably should go 1.1. And if you were like, no, I would take Mookie at this point, fine. But are you really going to take... And I love these players. Are you really going to take Kyle Tucker over Ronald Acuña Jr. because of 1 month? Are you really going to take Bobby Witt Jr. over Ronald Acuña Jr. because of 1 month? Maybe you already felt that way. You were in the extreme minority, if that's the case. Great for you for making that call so far through May 3rd or whatever it is. But I'm not ready to make that leap. If I have Ronald Acuña Jr., I'm so happy. I mean, I'm not, because I have him and I'm not in first place in those leagues. But I'm confident going forward that he's going to be perfectly fine. Yeah.
It is May 5th, 2 days later than May 3rd.
That changes things.
You should be a little bit more concerned. So I think that all makes sense. I think the things to keep in mind here are, and they come up, one of them comes up in the question itself, and another is just another topic to be aware of. But with a guy like Acuña and the season he had last year, do you remember, I don't know if people still talk about this, do you remember the Madden curse? There used to be the thing that like guys who were on the cover of Madden would have terrible years the next year. The reason for that is effectively that when guys have career years, their next year is worse. Like that's how it goes. That's what makes it a career year. And now it is always possible that a guy has a career year in 2023 and then has another career year in 2024, right? Guys, that can happen. But the reasonable expectation for Acuña was always that he would regress from what he did last year. If you were expecting him to repeat his 2023, that was a bad expectation. That said, he was still the clearly the best pick at the top of drafts. And we talked about that on the show. We said like it actually had been a long time since there was somebody who was so clearly the obvious first pick. And one thing, I'll be honest, I don't remember if I said this at the time. I should have said this at the time. If I didn't, or if I said the opposite of this at the time, I'll take my L for that. But even when a guy like Acuña is that clearly the 1.1, if you said to me before the season, who's going to be the top player in fantasy this year? Do you want Acuña or the field? I'll take the field. Every time. Being the 1.1 does not mean you are a 60, 70, even 51% chance of being the best player in fantasy this year. It means you have the best chance versus anyone else. And we talk about this with projections too, right? Like every year, the top home run projection is like from some system will be like 43 and someone will be like, someone's obviously going to hit 50 home runs and Dan Szymborski does zips or Derek Hardy does the bat. We'll be like, yes, someone's going to hit 50, but there is no individual player that should be projected to hit 50. And Dan will actually occasionally with zips share something that says like, what does Zips think the home run leader's total will be? And it'll be like 53 instead of the 43 that the biggest number is. But that's just because you don't know who's going to be the one who has that insane year, right? Somebody from the field was very likely, always very likely, to have a better season than Ronald Acuña Jr. There was just nobody who was a good idea to take above him if you had to bet on who it was going to be. But the fact that Acuña is not, like, the fact that he's been as bad as he is surprising. If he ends up as the fifth best fantasy player this year instead of first, that won't be like shocking. It won't be a reason to be like, wow, our process was bad. He shouldn't have been the first pick. Like, that's just, he probably won't be the top player in fantasy. That was true a month ago. It's even more true now. But if you had to pick somebody to be the top, he's still your best bet going
100%.
So I think that's sort of where that is with Acuña. Yeah, the strikeout rate is concerning. It is obviously possible he's just like totally fallen apart, but it's not what I expect. He's still walking at a high rate. His chase rate doesn't look too bad. He is swinging a bit more than you'd like. So maybe there's, you know, a little bit like we were talking with Ramirez, maybe he's pressing a bit, although I don't really think that's an issue for him. His home run per fly ball rate is way down. That shouldn't continue, especially given like his exit velocity looks fine. It's right around where it was 2 years ago. His hard hit rate looks fine. It's right around where it was 2 years ago. His barrel rate's down a bit, but I think that'll come back up. I just like, I think Acuña is like, he's having a slump. It's not going great for him. I think he's going to get right and be totally fine. So
agreed.
That's my overall take on Acuña. Let's do one more before our next break. Let's go back. Actually, let's talk about a strategic question. So we got a question from at Jeff. Lots of numbers. Jeff 652-78909
on
Twitter. And yeah, you know, there's the joke about first name, bunch of numbers, but it's a real question. So we're gonna answer it anyways. What is your approach to lineup construction in season as it relates to hot players versus cold stars? Do you bench cold stars and play streaky hitters versus play established but cold hitters? For example, Seager, Olson, Goldie, Yandy versus Larnach or Jeffers at util. And so I'll let you answer this first. I have some thoughts too, but I'll let you go first, Pete. What do you do when you've got a star player who's not living up to what you expected?
Sure. So I think the first thing that matters here is format, right? Because, you know, like we were just talking about two players who are currently, I guess, in a slump, right? Jose Ramirez and Ronald Acuña Jr. I'm not going to bench them at all. Those two, I'm never going to bench, period. Let the record show. But players like that, I'm not going to bench in rotisserie leagues because I started at the beginning of the year with what their stat line was going to be in my head. And I planned for that and I drafted for that. And so if I try to pick and choose when I'm going to deploy those players, I might not end up getting that entire baseline of statistics that I was hoping for. And now my planning for my team is all thrown off. In a head-to-head league, I think it's a little bit different. You know, we're just talking about a one-week sample. So those hot bats, you know, that can win you an entire week. Pitching matchups will matter as well. If I get a guy like, you know, I'm just guessing, I haven't looked at it in a while, but I'm willing to bet O'Neill Cruz isn't doing much against left-handed pitching this year, and he's off to a bad start. So am I going to bench him for some hot shortstop right now in a head-to-head league because, you know what, I need some hits and this guy's hot and O'Neill Cruz is playing a lefty? Absolutely, sure. But I'm less likely to do that in rotisserie because I don't want to mess with and ultimately ruin what could have been an ideal end-of-season stat line for my team because I tried to play God and manage those matchups. So I think it's a really format dependent strategy that I'm way more likely to do in head to head. But there's some players, guys, I understand with Corbin Carroll because he's just been so abysmal. But like, I'm not benching Matt Olson because I have, you know, I don't know, Brett Beatty as a corner infielder and he's coming off a 2-home run game. Like that just feels like an easy way to ruin your season.
Yeah. I think to me it's less format dependent and more player dependent. Right. And so like, I'm not worried about Matt Olson. However, I've also got Randy Arozarena on some teams similar area in the draft, similar overall value, streaky player, has a history of cold starts, has a history of getting into ugly slumps. And like, I think here's one of the beauties of fantasy baseball and really of baseball in general. It's a long season. And in head-to-head, like you bench a guy like a Rosarena in a head-to-head league on the day he happens to go off and hit two homers and steal two bases and drive in seven runs. Like you might cost yourself a matchup or part of a matchup or whatever. Long season, the playoffs are still there for you. That's probably not going to sink you. In a rotisserie league or a season-long points league, you bench him and you miss that day. That hurts your stats. It's a long season. That one day that you missed, probably not going to be the reason you win or lose the season. And so I have no problem with people choosing to ride streaks one way or the other. And I think the thing with, you know, it gets harder in a weekly lineups league, right? Because if you're like, you know what, we're recording right now on Sunday the 5th. This is going to come out on Monday the 6th. You're setting your lineups for Monday for a weekly lineup. And you're like, you know what? He's right. Randy's been cold. I'm benching him. He could hit six home runs and steal four bases and like just go off this week. And it would suck. In a daily league, if you're like, you know what? I just don't want him in my lineup Monday. I'd rather put Trevor Larnach in there because Larnach's been hitting the ball. And that may prove to be the wrong decision. It probably is not a good decision. But who cares? Like, if you feel better riding that streak, do it. And I've been doing that in some cases where I'm just like, you know what? We'll see. And then if Rosarena has that good day and seems like he's getting right, he'll be right back in my lineup the next day. And that's fine. So I do think for me, there are times where I'm like, look, I'm benching this guy. And I'm benching him for a day. And honestly, like this is super non-analytical. This isn't meaningful in any way. But like in that Podcasters League, the Auto New Podcasters League, 5x5, that's where I have a Rosarena. I also have Kyle Schwarber, who hasn't been very exciting in that league. I've also got Brian Reynolds, who's been okay, but I have a very busy, expensive outfield. And then I've got guys like, I think I might have Larnach in that league. I can't remember. I picked up some guys. I have Brent Rooker in that league. I'm benching a Rosarena occasionally. And part of my thinking is if he has a great day and I miss that great day, I'm going to be so happy that he's hitting again and that I can just plug him back into my lineup. I will get over missing that day. It will be fine. Now, I'm not actually his manager. And so I don't actually have the ability to like bench him and give him a mental health day and let him clear his head and get right. And so I understand that my benching him in fantasy doesn't actually impact Randy or Rosarena in any way. But there is a part of me that sometimes is like, you know what? It's just not working. Let's give him a day off. Let's see how it goes. And I'm sort of fine with that. Is it good process from an analytics standpoint, from like running the numbers and who is the right decision to play? No, it's not. But you know what? That's okay. It's fine to do that. And so I think for me, like I've got Jose Ramirez in a number of places. He's locked in my lineup. Everybody was complaining about Francisco Lindor like 3 weeks ago. I left him locked in my lineup. I've been thrilled with that. It's been great. He's been good again. I'm not benching Acuna. I might bench a Rosarena here and there. I might bench Kyle Schwarber here and there. It just, I don't know. And maybe there's not even good process behind which players I would do it with one and which ones I wouldn't, but that's how it goes for me.
No, I think, and I think viewing it from the other angle is important as well. It's not just like who's the player, because like you're never going to bench Jose Ramirez, but maybe, you know, that line is met with Randy or Rosarena, but it's also who you're replacing them with, right? Like if you're in a,
yeah,
like Christopher Morel was dropped in a couple of my leagues and I was able to pick him up. He's starting to hit again. To me, that's pretty high replacement value for a guy who's cold. If my option's like Nick Senzel, God bless him. Like, you know what? I'm just going to roll the dice with Randy or Rosarena again, because I don't think there's going to be that much of a difference. And I think this problem, it becomes a little bit more difficult when like I'm in a 12-team dynasty roto. I have Randy or Rosarena. I also have Nick Castellanos and Wyatt Langford. So like I have to sit one of them. I you can't roll out that many guys that are performing so poorly. Yeah. So if it was just a Rosarena, you know what? Fine. Like, let's see if he figures it out. I don't want to miss a big Randy game. But now with all three of those slugs, like I need to start making some moves. So it is a problem that can be compounded by other underperforming guys.
Yeah. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, I mentioned we were going to answer a question from Scott Chu, and I think we can do that next. All right, welcome back. We are talking about listener questions, listener hot takes, and Scott Chu, who is a listener, but is also a peer, a colleague on the Pitcherless Podcast Network. He asked, let me see, I make sure I have the wording right on this. Who is the worst player that you would accept in a trade for Corbin Carroll right now if you had to trade him? And he said, perhaps because speed is not a need. So let's take out the debate right now of like, you know, would you trade him? Because I think for a lot of people, especially in keeper leagues, the answer would be like, no, you don't, you can't trade him. But let's assume you could. And this is, we talked at the beginning of the episode regarding Wyatt Langford about redraft versus keeper and how different this is. I mentioned Scott Chu writes the hitter list. He has Corbin Carroll 27th on his list this week. That is a 13 spot drop from where he was last week. And he's been dropping before that. The guys around him, so I'll just read, starting at 22 on this list. 22 on the list is Corey Seager, Ozzie Albies, Gunnar Henderson, CJ Abrams, Michael Harris. Then he has a tier line between Harris and Corbin Carroll at 27. And the next guys below Carroll are Altuve, Lindor, Schwarber, Vlad, Machado, Bichette. The rest of that tier, Jazz Chisholm, Christian Walker, Alex Bregman. So the question here is, who is the worst player you would accept in a trade for Corbin Carroll? And I'm going to note that I think that there's a very different answer for me in redraft versus keeper leagues. But Pete, curious what you're thinking on this is.
Well, I mean, yes, first of all, to what you just said, there's a huge difference. I have Corbin Carroll in a number of leagues on like a 20th round keeper value. So yeah. Even if there's something seriously wrong with that shoulder that needs to be addressed, like, I'm still holding on to Corbin Carroll because even 2 years from now, he's going to be a massive bargain. I hope nobody's like out on the player. It should be pointed out, and I know this isn't really news to a lot of people, but in late June last year, he had that shoulder injury scare. He kind of came right back. Yeah. The manager said the shoulder looks strong. Since July 1st to now, it's a WRC plus of 102. Nine home runs in 463 plate appearances. Now let's combine that to before that injury, from just April 1st to let's call it, I got to expand this to June, and I'm sure the numbers are going to be even better, to June 30th, 2023. That's a WRC plus of 148, 316 plate appearances, 17 home runs. The average exit velocity during that time was 90.8. Since the injury to now, that's dropped to 87.8. His average exit velocity is in the range of like Johan Rojas right now. It's seriously like bottom 15 in all of baseball for those that are eligible. So in the short term, like, there's a lot of guys I might trade him for one for one. And I think we actually got to it in that list where you went from Jose Altuve, Francisco Lindor, two guys who I think I would trade Corbin Carroll for. And then we got like Schwarber, Vlad, and Machado, who are all kind of underperforming, or maybe just some of them taking a step back. It's basically just guys who, like, I'd rather just see what I have in Corbin Carroll, because I think even a hurt Corbin Carroll is better than he's been and could be pretty good, particularly in the stolen base department. So I guess to answer the question by Scott's rankings, we're talking Altuve and Lindor, but I'm curious, Chad, in redraft, are you lowering the bar even more? Would you trade him for something even less fancy?
Yeah, I mean, I'm scrolling down a little bit further, and the next tier down, the top of his next tier down are his top three catchers, Adley Rutschman, William Contreras, Will Smith. If I needed a catcher and not an outfielder in a redraft, I could see it. I'm concerned about the shoulder. The performance hasn't been good. And again, this is you have to trade him, right? You're not in it. You can't use him. He provides stuff you don't need, whatever it is. Going further down that list, like Brian Reynolds, if I needed outfield, though, he hasn't been particularly good either.
He's walking a lot, though. So OBP, maybe.
Yeah. We've talked about Josh Naylor. I'm really high on Josh Naylor this year.
That'd be a tough
He's in that next tier. Yeah. But I think, like, I would move pretty far down that list. At least I would move down a tier. Let's just go with that. I would move down a tier on this list. There's guys in that next year that I'd be like, yeah, in redraft. Because I don't think Carroll is just in a slump. I think he's hurt. I just everything correlates too neatly with that injury scare last year. And I'm worried about it. And so I want that production. I want to win. And so I want to get that production in my lineup as quick as I can. In a keeper league, which, you know, for us, obviously a very different question. I don't know. Like, I don't know. I'm going very far down this list at all. Again, Altuve and Lindor are close enough in production, especially if I need middle infield, that like, I totally get that. But I think there I'm with you. Like, I don't know that I want to move him for Schwarber in a keeper league. Hell, I think I'd rather just sit on that long-term value. Because my big concern with Carroll, the big concern with Carroll has to be that the shoulder is meaningfully damaged and he's just never going to be the player we hoped he would be. There is risk of that. I think that's an overreaction to what we've seen so far. My risk with him, my big concern with him is that we're 2 weeks away from him announcing surgery. And this being a lost season, which I think is totally possible.
I think it's totally possible, but my God, would that just be such a terrible look for the Diamondbacks? You just keep rolling this guy out there, and every fan and every analyst is like, Corbin Carroll clearly has something really wrong with his shoulder. Are they the only ones that aren't seeing this? And to give them maybe an ounce of credit, like, could it just be that his sophomore slump started a little bit early and it just perfectly lined up with the shoulder injury? It's giving Arizona a lot of credit here, but like, I'm sorry, if this guy does go down in the next week or two with some season-ending shoulder surgery, like, what the hell were the Diamondbacks doing all this time?
So here's my take on this as a non-doctor. Okay, so I'll be very clear here. I'm not a doctor. Do not take my medical advice.
Dr. Young.
I tore my rotator cuff earlier this year. Actually, technically late last year, right around New Year's, I tore my rotator cuff. One of the things that the doctor told me, I ended up not needing surgery. He said, it's going to take a while to heal. And I said, surgery, it'll be like a longer healing process, sort of, but it'll take you longer to get use back, but you'll be quicker to 100%, whatever. But in the meantime, he was like, it's sort of a pain management thing. Cause I was joking about like, oh, well, my family's going skiing again next week and it's hurt myself skiing. And I was like, I'll just go skiing again. He's like, you could. He's like, if you can tolerate the pain, you're not going to injure it further. Corbin Carroll is a different human being doing different things. But one possibility here is they know there's an injury. There is no risk of further injury. And they have been working on the assumption that they are better off and that he is better off playing through this and getting himself, playing himself back to strength. And that at some point, a couple of things will change the dynamics on that. One is, at some point, the slump and the problems go on too long. Another is that the pain just becomes less manageable. And the third is that, like, they're already 7.5 out in the division, right? And, like, I know it's a team that was in the World Series last year, and it's hard to imagine them being like, all right, forget it, we're blowing it up. But, like, they're 7.5 out of the division, they're 3 out of the wild card, they're not playing very well. There is some point at which it becomes not worth it to keep him on the field. And as an example, we talked about Jose Ramirez earlier. One of those big slumps Jose Ramirez had came after he injured his thumb. And it was, you know, he ended up needing, I think he needed surgery or something after the season, but like, it was one of these things where it, as far as I can tell, the Guardians and Jose and everyone else felt like replacing him for the time it would take to get him right is worse than having 80% of him in the lineup every day. Now, Carroll hasn't been 80%. And so that's another thing here. But if they think like, look, he can play through this, he can be 80, 90% of the player he's been, and we'll deal with this in the offseason, and that's what's best for the team long term, and he's not going to injure himself, and Like, there's a valid explanation for that being their path forward. I don't know what's going on. I can't, like, so I'm just, all I'm trying to do is say, like, I think there is a world in which the Diamondbacks are not doing anything inappropriate. They're not risking him. They're not forcing him to do something he shouldn't be doing. They're not making a mistake. They're taking a calculated risk. That calculated risk is right now not working. And at some point, the calculations on that risk change, and the decision to have Carroll shut it down becomes an easier decision than it is right now, and certainly than it was when the season started. Because if you were them when the season started and your choices were shut him down, maybe lose him for the whole season, or see if we can compete for another World Series berth, another pennant, with a guy playing at 80% of full strength, I totally get why they would make the decision they made, as long as it wasn't endangering his long-term success.
I get that. And I mean, like, look, not a doctor either, right? Not sure I need to sedate that. But yeah. If they were told, like, hey, he is not at risk of furthering this current injury, okay, but he's 23 years old. And when guys play hurt, they're at risk at compensating for that injury and hurting themselves in other ways, and all sorts of things can go wrong. So you're taking the face of your franchise, who in his rookie season got you to the World Series, and I feel like you're playing with fire if he really is injured and you just keep rolling him out there. And if that is the ultimate decision, well, they better come to that soon, because it's not working. The dude has a 61 WRC plus so far this season. He's got one homer in 141 plate appearances. It's not happening. He's hitting under 200. So, like, make a call, because if it is an injury, I don't see how this ends well with them continuing to roll him out there. And so if you are a fantasy manager who has him and you think, like Chad, like, this is an injury, like, this is something that at some point is going to have to be rested or addressed or whatever it might be, then you should lower the bar for what you should trade him for, and you should get out. Because if it's a shoulder injury, man, it's not going to heal by swinging at 98 mile an hour fastballs.
Yeah. So we've been going for an hour here. We've still got a few questions left. And so I want to try to lightning round the end of this. And so we're going to go back at another question from Kevin Conlon 12 on Twitter. One more from me, just regular rookie struggles from a barely 20-year-old, or have we seen reason to be genuinely concerned about the long-term value of Jackson Churio? I feel like I could have put Jackson Holliday at the end of this question just as much. Any reaction to either of those guys, both of those guys? Are you worried about the Jacksons?
I'm going to tackle Churio first, and then I'll be really quick on Holliday. I have no long-term concerns for either of these players. Churio's not only young, yeah. Chad, he can't have his first beer until spring training next year. When you consider that,
which is too bad, because the way he's playing, he could probably use a beer right now.
Maybe. I mean, if you look at his projections before the season from most projection websites, he's basically on pace for four of the five by five categories. And the one that he's not is batting average. And that's because he's striking out over 30% of the time, which we thought he might have some strikeout struggles. He's had them in a little bit in the past. It looked like they were healed last year, but he's had them in the past in the minor leagues. And, like, again, he's 20 years old. Here are some of the names that he has struck out to this year: Edwin Diaz, Logan Gilbert, Andres Munoz, Bryce Miller, Dylan Cease, Michael King, Sonny Gray, Jared Jones, Carlos Rodon, Luis Severino, Ryan Pepiot. Those are tough matchups for just about any major leaguer, let alone a guy who is 20 years old. So I think folks are disappointed, because in redraft formats, he was going pretty pricey. And yeah. I fell into that too. I have him in a few redraft leagues, and I'm regretting it. But, like, I think he's fine long term. Yeah. And the Brewers also have the second best WRC plus in baseball. They're in first place. I think they can afford to kind of let him figure it out at the major league level. So at least on that front, I'm looking forward to continued steals, potentially some homers. And I think he's fine. I don't have any long-term concerns about him. And Holliday, it wasn't just bad. It was terrible, but
it was ugly.
Let's reference Mike Trout again. Let's reference Alex Bregman again. There have been equally terrible debuts. Jackson Holliday is, who knows? He's a prospect. He could completely bust, but I don't think I'm ready to change my evaluation of him based on 30 plate appearances or whatever the heck it was.
I think the thing with both of the Jacksons is, and this part of this applies more to Churio, which is Churio last year, he had 24 plate appearances in AAA. That's all he's seen in AAA, is those 24 plate appearances. And so he basically is jumping from AA to the majors at age 20. He also His double A numbers last year were good. They weren't great. They were good. They were very good. And he had a 112 WRC plus in double A. That is an above average season. And for a 19-year-old, like, I don't want to downplay what he did. For a 19-year-old, that is super impressive. But a 112 WRC plus in double A doesn't scream going to be a star in Major League Baseball tomorrow. A 19-year-old doing that in double A does scream, this guy is going to be a star eventually. But I don't think it's a total shock that he's struggling to adapt a little bit. And I think there's a bigger picture thing here with both Holiday and Churio and others that, like, it's hard to transition to Major League Baseball. And I think people get overexcited about these prospects. Wyatt Langford falls into the same category, and they start to dream on the upside and draft the upside. And you can't do that. These guys are going to struggle on average. Not always. There will always be the prospect who just shows up on day one. You know, you remember Juan Soto, who hit his first career home run before his debut because he showed up for that suspended game, right?
I do not remember that. Technically, but that's amazing.
He got called. They had a game suspended. He got called up, and then when they finished the suspended game, he was on the roster and came in as like a pinch hitter into the suspended game.
That's awesome.
So the stats from that game are from before his call up, and he had ended up hitting a home run. Great story. But anyways, that's not the point. The point is, like, there are guys like Soto who come up and are just good. That happens. It's not impossible, but it's not the norm. Even for top prospects, it's not the norm. And so, you know, you have to be patient with these guys, but you also have to be smarter about what you pay for them at drafts and auctions, because especially in redraft, like, there's a really good chance, there's a very, very good chance that Churio and Holiday are both not rosterable in redraft this year. Totally possible. They might both be very good. I'm not saying you have to go drop them immediately. It would depend on what's going on with your league, blah, 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 blah. But, like, those guys being not usable in redraft wouldn't be a huge surprise. They're young, they're learning, they're developing. It's going to take a little time. Question from, and then we had one last question. This is from Matt Choman on Twitter. Need some names for relief pitcher help in Fangraphs points. He's looking at Yency Almonte and Calvin Foucher. Fauché? I don't know how to pronounce that. But open to other suggestions. Pete, have you seen any interesting Fangraphs points relievers out there that this guy, Matt, should be taking a look at?
Yeah, I started taking a look right when we started recording. One name that I like that I don't know how available he is anymore, so I wasn't able to find him in a short amount of time, is Fernando Cruz, who his most recent outing was really ugly. So I think you have an opportunity to maybe buy low. But if you look at his strikeouts per nine this year, I mean, it's right up there with like Mason Miller. And he did it last year too. And I think he kind of flew under the radar because he was an older reliever. I've got him up now, rostered in only 10%, or no, that's OPL. His roster rate is actually wicked high, so this is not helpful anymore. So let me go back to the drawing board. I did not realize his roster rate over the last 30 days, his roster rate has gone up 78%. So I'm going to turn it over to Chad and continue to look. But if Cruz was somehow available, or you could buy low because his last outing was so bad, he's a guy I would target.
Yeah. I mean, to start with, I think there's a couple of things I would do. So I'm not going to, before I name names, I would go to the search page on your league and filter down to just relief pitchers and starting pitchers, click the free agents only button and hit search, and then sort by points per inning pitch and just start scrolling through that list and see who pops up as an interesting name off that list from the top down. I did sort of that. I then went and looked at, I did that looking at roster percentage below 60 to try to find guys who were at least plausibly available. And one of the top names that popped up there is Trent Thornton. Thornton isn't great. He's not striking out a ton of guys. His walk rate isn't like elite, but he's been pitching well, 2.40 FIP. He is getting holds. He's got three holds already, and he's also throwing a decent number of innings. He's already made 14 appearances, 13.1 innings pitched. Those are all things I'm looking for. Now, the Mariners have some relievers coming back, and so it is possible that Thornton isn't getting hold soon or isn't even on the roster soon, to be honest. But that was a name that jumped out at me. Richard Lovelady, who is a guy we talked about a couple of years ago, I feel like he was like, looked like he might burst onto the scene after some great minor league performances. He's only thrown 3 innings and 3 appearances for the Cubs, but I don't know. I'm sort of interested in him. He looked pretty good in AAA so far this year. He's been good in his appearances so far and already gotten a hold in one of his 3 appearances. So he's rostered in 0% of leagues. So you can definitely go get him if you need to. He's a guy like he might get sent down in a week. And so you might only have him briefly. But it is interesting. Like there are only a total of 5 pitchers who are over 7 points per inning pitched and rostered in less than 60% of leagues. My search is wrong. I'm going to correct this. I was looking at 0.6% of leagues.
Wow. That's
so those guys are available in 0.6. Let me redo this search and see if I get better results. Ah, there we go. Okay. So guys who are healthy and throwing well. I think there was a lot of negative talk about Lucas Ursegg before the season because they were like, he's really going to supplant Mason Miller as the closer. And like, no, he has not done that. He has 2 saves and 7 holds in 14 appearances and is almost at 10 points per inning pitched. He is 50% rostered. Ursegg is a guy I would definitely look at. Adam Ottavino, he's over almost at 9 points per inning pitched.
That was one that I was going to say, too. He's consistently good every year, it feels like. Yeah. So, I mean, kind of an underappreciated. He's right on the line, 55%. But that's one who I recently added him in our Fangraphs Points League. I like Adam. Yeah.
Danny Coulomb on the Orioles, I think I'm pronouncing that right, is at 8.85. He's shown some good performance in the past, and so I'm intrigued by him. Austin Adams, I've picked up Austin Adams in a number of leagues. He's made 15 appearances. He only thrown 10 and a third innings, but he has 8 holds in 10 and a third innings, which in a Fangraphs points format, like he has 32 points. He's getting 3 points per inning, over 3 points per inning, roughly 3 points per inning off of just holds. Then he gets all the innings pitched and all that. So like he's at 8.33 points. He's at only 9.06% rostered. I think Austin Adams should probably be rostered everywhere in Fangraphs points. Like he should go, he should be picked up. Like I don't know. He walks too many guys. Like there's risk here, but his ground ball rate is up this year, which is helpful. So he's going to hopefully give up less home runs. He pitches in Oakland this year, which will help him give up less home runs. It is a team that is somehow winning games, but it's not like they have a stacked bullpen where he's going to lose saves and holds and stuff like that to anyone other than Miller. And I guess he's now the third A we've mentioned. So maybe his bullpen is good, but I think he's going to continue to pile up those holds. It's like Austin Adams, I'd be picking up everywhere. I would. So, and then I'm interested. I don't know how this is going to work out for Cleveland, but they have been riding Cade Smith, among others. At one point, I think the Guardians had the top 4 relievers in baseball in terms of appearances. And Cade Smith is among that group. He is at almost 8 points per inning pitched. He is at 58.75% rostered. He only has 2 holds, but I think he's been sort of moving up in the pecking order. Those 2 holds are both in his last 5 appearances. So I'm really intrigued by Cade Smith as well.
One more name I'd throw out there is John Schreiber for the Royals. I don't know if you mentioned him on that list, Chad, but that's another bullpen that is not stacked. Schreiber's been setting up for James MacArthur, who I'm not that big on to begin with, so maybe there's potential opportunity for him to take over the closer role at some point. Schreiber's been good in the past, the last couple seasons for the Red Sox. He was pretty productive. The strikeouts haven't really been there this year, but he also hasn't given up a home run yet, and he's up over 7.5 Fangraph points per game. And he's rostered only around like 23% of leagues. So if you're looking at someone with like could eventually maybe even get that closer role upside, get a few more points in there. And in the meantime, at least be getting you holds, I think Schreiber is a pretty good bet.
Yeah. So there's some names for you, Matt. And we're now almost at 1.25 hours, which makes it the perfect time to stop and go enjoy our Sundays. I've got a basketball game to watch in 37 minutes.
Good game.
Go see if by the time you guys are listening to this, I will either be getting ready to watch my Cavs be dismantled by the Celtics or getting ready to watch my Cavs be dismantled by the front office. But it'll be one of the two.
There's a dismantling coming.
They're going to be dismantled by someone. It's just a question of who. But in the meantime, I'll be watching lots of baseball today. There's a ton of fun games on. And I'll be making some decisions. We are in May. I'm going to make some decisions on some cuts. Some guys, it's time to move on from. And Pete, maybe we could talk about that next week and let people know who we've just bailed on, who we're done with. But thank you all for your questions. Thanks for listening. And we will be back with you next week.